order the meeting for the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection. Thanks to everyone for being here. Today's meeting, we have the agenda out, which includes informational meeting in the beginning, and then we have a work session to introduction of some committee bills that have been forwarded for us to just get into the process. I do want to form the record, there's been a task group or work group that's been working with the DCBS, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, regarding identity theft as it pertains to consumers and protection for consumers. That meeting ended this morning for the last of the interim workshop or work group meetings that will continue into the regular session this next time. I've asked Lou Savage to just come over just for very briefly, since this is one of the bill areas that we had been discussing during the interim work, to give us a very quick update as to where the work group is at and how that work group will proceed during the beginning of the session, and I expect that the legislation will be advanced based on the conclusion of that work. Lou?
Chair Posonski, members of the committee, my name is Lou Savage. I'm a senior policy advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'll just briefly give you an update as to what has been going on with the work group. I've testified before this committee about the work group activities, and it, as Chair Posonski said, it's really to help craft some consumer protection legislation in the area of identity theft. The goals really were pretty clear to the work group, and it's a broad work group consisting of consumer advocates and industry representatives. The goals were to provide a level of assurance to consumers that their personal information will be safeguarded, to decrease the incidence of identity theft in a meaningful way, to reduce damage done to victims of identity theft, and to not unduly burden business. So those were the goals that we were working off of. And the bill itself has just a few key elements to safeguard personal information, to provide notification if there is a breach of personal information, to allow for a consumer to freeze their credit file if they're a victim or possibly concerned about their personal information being subject to being theft from identity, and protecting social security numbers. So those are the key elements. We really have made a lot of progress. I'd say we're about 75% to 80% there in terms of legislation. The work group has been working since June, and the members of the work group have spent a lot of time coming to agreement on most of the key elements. There are a few outstanding issues, one of which is who would be eligible for a credit freeze. Should it just be a victim of identity theft? Am I not on? Okay.
Oh, you're okay. It's just that we didn't have the phone plugged in.
We were wondering why
it wasn't working. Yeah. It's probably because we didn't check to see it was plugged in.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your expert advice here.
Yeah, good technical expertise.
And we'll take that off the camera. Thank you.
So one of the issues is who would be eligible for a credit freeze, and it seems that most folks in the work group think that all consumers ought to have the right to a security freeze, but that there ought to be a small charge for folks who are not victims of identity theft. One of the other issues is the standard for notification of a breach. What's the standard for an entity that has personal information where the information has been lost or stolen for notification to consumers? Should there be a reasonable belief that the information will fall into the wrong hands, for example? And then I guess the other big issue is enforcement. If the statute is not adhered to, what enforcement mechanisms are available to consumers or possibly a state agency with respect to any violations of the statute. At this point, everyone agrees that the common law negligence would be available to a consumer if there's damage that is a result of a breach of security where there's not been notification, for example. But the question is, should there be more than that available in the statute? For example, should a state agency be charged with enforcement of the statute, and what should that look like? For example, should DCVS have some authority to have enforcement if there's a violation of the statute, or should the Department of Justice have some enforcement tools as well? And there's general agreement that there ought to be something besides just negligence, that there ought to be some state role in enforcing the provisions of this consumer protection law. The question is, what should that be, and what should it look like, and how should the penalties be structured? That's really all that's left on the table in terms of the issues that are still not resolved. So we're very optimistic that by the time this bill is ready to be heard by a committee next session, there will just be a very few issues left to be worked out. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you. I want to give one clarification. If I didn't, I'm not sure if that was mentioned or not. This would apply not only to private entities, it also would be public bodies. So if you have a governmental unit that is somehow breached the confidentiality of personal information of an individual, they would be held to a standard similar to a private corporation. So it's not just the private corporations that are going to be under this, but the state, county, and city governmental units as well. So are there any other questions for Mr. Savage? Senator Starr.
Thank you. Just as part of the work group, who are some of the industry representatives that represent?
Just walked in the door.
To represent the small businesses. Yeah, I think, as you look at this, from my perspective, it's one thing to put new regulation on, say, large businesses that maybe have a lot of expertise or a lot of capacity to deal with these kinds of things. And it's a lot different when you're dealing with smaller businesses, the Main Street businesses that, smaller 1 and 2 and 3 employee kind of things. Talk to me that makes you make me feel comfortable that the gamut is being represented here.
Chair Przanski, Senator Starr, that's a very good question. And we made a real effort to bring a broad range of industry representatives into the discussion. AOI has been very involved in the discussion and had a particular concern about small businesses. There's one provision concerning the breach of security and the safeguarding of personal information, where we're trying to specifically address small business needs. We have folks from Electronics Association, Financial Services. And that's kind of a broad range of folks in that group in terms of, everyone from a large financial institution to a small mortgage broker. My sense is that people are pretty satisfied with the representation, and that those issues, those small business issues, have been brought out.
Well, Mr. Chair, just for the record, as this moves forward, and I know this is something that will likely be legislated, making sure that the Main Street business folks are not overly burdened by a new rule, new regulation, new law is something that's going to require significant, or going to have significant scrutiny, at least from this particular legislator.
No. Chair Przanski, Senator Starr, we are very sensitive to that. One of the reasons that we wanted to bring people together prior to the session was to really hash out those issues, and we spent a fair amount of time not only on the safeguarding piece, but on notification. There's a specific provision in the notification section which says that if you have to notify a certain number of people, there's a threshold, and you have an alternative means of notification other than just, you know, personal contact mailing. There's a basically a publication provision which addressed the concern that some businesses had that it would be too expensive to notify people if there is a breach. So there is that threshold that we built in. That's an example of an area that we worked on specifically because businesses raised that as a concern.
Yeah, once we get something that's under STAR, hopefully you'll have an opportunity to review it and see if it meets your level. And it's been as best we could, an open process. There are some exceptions for small businesses, and actually using the current statutory definition of what a small business is, and there's different, considerations that have been taking place. And like I said, it's still a work in progress. Since we just completed our meeting today, I wanted to ask Mr. Savage to just come over and give us a heads up, not knowing how the committees are going to be configured, but since it's something that we worked on during the interim early, at least he knew what had been going on during the latter part of this interim period. So, Ms. Savage, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, do you want to go ahead? We're going to try to get Representative Gordon Anderson on the phone now that we've plugged it in, and probably we'll have a dial tone that will allow us to let him participate in the next portion of the meeting. And
Hi, Representative Anderson. We're in a committee now, the Senate Consumer Protection Committee, and we're about to start a discussion regarding construction-related issues, and so we wanted to bring you in to listen to that discussion.
Thank you very much.
Well, Representative Anderson, this is Senator Przanski. How are you doing today?
Well, I hope you're doing well, Senator.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being willing to join us. We have at the diocese, for your information, Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, and Senator Devlin, currently, besides myself. We have two items on the informational meeting that we're now going to go into. One is Construction Claims Task Force update. The other is the Construction and Building Codes Enforcement Issues. I didn't know if you wanted to participate in both of those sections, or if you only wanted one, we'd start with the one that you wanted to be part of.
Well, very briefly, and I could probably summarize my thoughts on both of them, because I do have some concerns for both of them. But there's one third issue, and that's the under your committee. For the record, this is Courtney Anderson, representative from District 3. And that is just consumer protection overall. I just wanted to make a few comments on all three of those issues.
Okay.
At your convenience.
Representative Anderson, not knowing what your schedule is, we're more than willing to listen to your comments now. And if you didn't want to listen to the testimony or the information we'll be receiving from the agencies involved, or I'll give you your choice if you want to make some statements now, later, or if you want to do maybe reserve the right to do both.
Well, for convenience for me, it would be great if I could make the comments now, and then I'll listen as long as I can, and then I will be getting the email report on CCTF.
Okay, that would be great. Why don't you go ahead, Representative?
Thank you very much. First of all, I don't know whether Eric Grassberger is there with you today to present any of the information or if it's staff, but I'd really like to give some kudos to Mr. Grassberger for, I think, doing a wonderful job on CCTF. He has done some excellent work, I think, in the whole area of looking at many of the different states and even provinces and culling the best on materials for building and some of the codes. I hope there will be more done in terms of the codes because, in my estimation, from what I've been able to gather, we are dropping below the level of the national code in several areas, especially in seismic. Now, that was not an area that the bill we wrote in the legislature last year gave for parameters to the task force, but I think we need to be looking at that as well, and just the general area. As you senators look at the problems of BCD and CCD, I think we need to be in the future looking at some of the codes and saying, are we allowing them to be driven to lesser standards by the consumer, by the contractors and builders, by the unions? What's going on? And definitely we need to bring them back into line with the national code, and I think in every area, and maybe even be above the national code in the seismic areas, because we are so close to some major faults. I think we also have some problems with inspectors in terms of the building codes. Senator Przanski, you, I think, were to be admired because you, like I, crawled around under some houses to look at some of the problems that had stuck by an inspector in Lane County. I was just incredulous as to some of the things that went down that the builder walked away on and made a deal with the homeowner and left him standing. And the homeowner made some very, very stupid mistakes. But was it really his place to know what was adequate building to the standard, or was it the builder or the inspector? I think it falls to the inspector, because as mayor in Grants Pass, the building inspector could okay or nix anything. He was the captain of the ship, and if he didn't like it, even if it wasn't legal, he could let it go through. So I think we need to cut the rope a little bit, shorten the rope on some of the inspectors around the state, and be sure that they can be brought up short if they make decisions that are poor decisions. Now, Lane County had to settle with this homeowner graciously, because they, in effect, were off the hook, but I don't think it should be up to the county to have to pay off for bad mistakes by the inspectors. I think we need to have some legislation that will give teeth to enforcement by Mark Long and Craig Smith and their agencies. Right now, I think they kind of feel that their hands are tied, and they need to have more and more protection so they can go into a county and enforce good building, and building that won't come back to bite the homeowner. There's one thing I wanted to say in terms of the inspectors also, and also more on the contractor side. John Stewart, who testified at length before the committee, before the task force, basically lost $300,000-$400,000 to a rogue contractor, and he is still practicing. There's no way to get him out. He lost his license, but that meant nothing to him. He went on and now is working for another contractor. I think you all remember the surgeon who was practicing in Portland, who killed a few patients and just blindly moved off to Australia. He's now being sued in Australia and probably will go to jail. But the point is, if we have a contractor who's doing terrible things to the consumer and can get away with it by just going under the radar and working for somebody else, there's got to be a way to protect the consumer, and that's your committee's work. I hope that we can tighten up the rules and laws in a way such that he doesn't go about killing other people to the tune of $300,000-$400,000 and laughing at them. He's been avoiding them in court and basically taking advantage of consumers. So the final thing I'd like to say is, and I think it's included in what you'll hear this afternoon, is a recovery fund. I know as attorneys you give money to different funds to make possible indigent attorneys care for clients that don't have the money. In dentistry, we pay money in for charity work. And it seems to me that a recovery fund that has been suggested to this task force, I think it's been between $20 and $40, that's a pittance. And I think we ought to be thinking $50 minimum for each contractor in the state, such that if there are cases where there's been terrible wrong done to a homeowner or to a business owner who, through construction, has been deceived and ripped off, the 28,000 construction contractors in the home building business would, with $50, create several million dollars in a recovery fund. And it seems to me that over a five-year period of time, with a sunset after 5 years, there would be more than enough money to pay back partially. Some of the homeowners or small businesses, say up to $500,000 worth of building cost, pay them off for things that they've been hurt on, and if they're rightfully entitled to it. And over that 5 years period of time, I think you'd see that the contractors realize, that the rogue contractors realize, I can't get away with it. And the other good contractors, which are probably 27,950, would put such pressure on the guys who are creating all the problems that you wouldn't need a recovery fund after 5 years. And so I recommend highly that if that is, in fact, in the final recommendations, that you would heartily endorse it. And if it isn't, I hope you'll consider it, because I know Chairman Grassberger and several others have indicated that they think it's a fair idea. And I will say this, that the task force was made up heavily of people in the industry and not very heavily by people who are consumers. And we'll be watching very closely the vote as to who's voting for and who's voting against things that protect the consumer. So with that, thank you very much for letting me throw my ideas in. I did testify before the task force, and to be able to come before your body is a real pleasure and an honor. Thank you very much, and I wish you the very best in protecting the consumer.
Representative Anderson, thank you very much. I'm going to ask if anyone has any questions for Representative Anderson. We don't, so if you want to stand by and listen to whatever amount of the testimony you'd like to, feel free to do so. We understand at some point you may be leaving our presence.
Thank you. I'll make the click very silent.
Uh-huh. With that said, I guess what we can do is start up with the Construction Claims Task Force update. And Mr. Long, I think you're going to be providing us with some of that. And Mr. Smith? Great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long with State Building Codes Division. We're part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Let me just make sure. Representative Anderson, are you able to hear?
Yes, but if they can get as close to the microphone as possible without feedback, that'd be great.
Would you mind?
Actually, it's more important.
All right.
Thank you.
And Chair Przanski, for the record, it's Craig Smith. I'm here to answer questions. Mark's going to do the heavy lifting, explaining to you what's been going on with the task force today.
All right, thank you. If you want to bring a chair over, maybe just sit on top of the chair.
Thank you.
Just pull one of the chairs off the side.
Why don't you just take the whole thing and move the whole thing over there? There you go.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll give this a try. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have a couple documents that we handed out ahead of time on the Construction Claims Task Force. The first document, the single-page document, just provides a little bit of background about the task force. I think we've updated you in the past with that. It also talks about the schedule. And I'll just let you know that I think we've had 13 meetings of the task force to date. We've got one next Friday, and then we believe we're going to wrap up on the 20th of December with our final meeting scheduled in January, but my hope is at that point it's just wrap-up and ceremonial. What I'd really like to talk to you about are the actual recommendations that are in front of you, and at this point, although the task force, and I can't speak for the task force, hasn't made its final recommendations, these are the items that are in play. And I feel pretty comfortable sitting here today that you're going to have some form of recommendation around these highlighted areas. Okay, we're still working on periods and commas in the task force, but the areas that are listed here, and I'm going to walk through them just a little bit, I feel pretty comfortable will come forward in final recommendations to the legislature as part of the task force report. Are there any questions before I start? Okay, great. If you look at on the first page, there are a series of recommendations around providing expansion to the already licensing enforcement capabilities that the Construction Contractors Board has. Each of those bullets represents a particular theme. To date, in fact, we had public comment last week. I don't believe there's going to be any significant change to this list of recommendations coming out of the task force. At our last public comment, there wasn't any opposition or any concern. I haven't heard any lately. I don't know if you have, Craig, but I think you're going to see something along with the lines from the task force with these six bulleted recommendations that are in front of you. I'd be happy to kind of go through them if you'd like, or just kind of move on. I think you can see them for yourself.
That's fine.
All right. On the building code proposals, the same thing. These are changes to do two things: prevent moisture from getting in the building to start with, and then if it does get in, provide additional ventilation to get it out. During the course of the testimony from the task force, most of the issues, I'm recalling about 75% of the defects consumers were seeing that resulted in insurance claims, came from moisture, water, getting into the building. And once it got in, then the damage that it created. So there are some changes in the building code to proactively keep it out, make sure that we don't cover buildings that have a particular moisture content. If there's water present, we can't cover the building. And then additional mechanical features to get the water out. Recovery fund, turning to the second page that Representative Anderson talked about. The task force did receive public comment this last last meeting with concerns over the recovery fund proposal. But it's my sense, in working with the task force chair and others, that there'll probably be a recommendation along the lines of what you see here, okay, coming to the legislature. This is a limited recovery fund, and you have to be careful when you talk about recovery fund, because one can assume that recovery means that I have damages and then I get completely compensated. And what's set up here would not provide that to consumers, but it would provide some recovery between this, the bond, and I know that you've proposed increased bond amounts as part of your pre-session filing, is that correct?
That's correct.
Between the increased bond amounts and the recovery fund, we believe we can do better for the consumers to recover some money, but this will not, so I call it a limited recovery fund, this will not make people 100%. A lot of discussion about getting additional consumer information in the hands of homeowners, et cetera, before you hire a contractor, and so there's a whole series of changes around consumer information. You can kind of see those for yourselves. We think that that's a good idea. Consumer information along with media campaigns, better use of the website. I know, Craig, you've done some updates with your website to provide additional information to consumers. The task force felt fairly strongly about. We also felt that the permitting standards could use some additional measures from as far as knowing who the contractors are, what work they're doing, and making sure before the work is approved on a residential structure that there are certain steps that have been taken by the contractor before a certificate of occupancy has been granted. So there's a series of recommendations around working with permits and permit standards. One of the larger pieces of the recommendations is on this next page called Building Envelope Certification Proposal. And within that proposal, this is an idea where if you work on the envelope of a building, of a residential structure, roofs, walls, windows, etc., you would need to, within your contractor company, have at least one individual obtain certification on envelope construction. Right now, I don't know how familiar the committee is, but right now, from the CCD licensing standpoint, as I understand it, Craig, most of the requirements around kind of business education and business knowledge and actual construction knowledge, you don't have a separate competency test, if you will. And this would require a separate competency test for those individuals that work on envelopes, which is new, and it's a pretty important piece of the package of recommendations. I don't know if you want to add anything to that or not.
Well, committee members, again, Craig Smith, Contractors Board, it is somewhat revolutionary. We don't have in this state a competency requirement for construction contractors at this point. This would move us towards that direction, certainly for envelope contractors. There are proposals here that would require education for the individuals that are actually do the work and some other requirements for the businesses. And I think that I know the task force is very interested in this and believes that this is an important component to stopping the leaky structures.
Another component of this particular proposal, because it has several different elements, is also continuing education. Right now in the general contracting area, again, if I'm wrong, go ahead and jump in, we don't have a continuing education requirement for contractors, and this would require that contractors receive code change update as the codes are changed in Oregon basically on an every 3-year basis. We currently have that model in the electrical, plumbing, boiler, I'm not sure if it's in the elevator world, and some of the licenses I oversee. This would add that requirement as well, and this whole kind of competency and then ongoing continuing education proposal. That's a very significant piece, and it's a big shift in the way that we've done business previously in the state of Oregon. Those previous proposals I talked about, we call those the phase one concepts. That really deals with trying to prevent the defect from occurring, making better building code standards, training and educating the workforce, and then having some additional enforcement standards should there be a problem. That's all on the kind of the construction side. The task force has also looked at affordability and availability of insurance and to see if there's any way we can improve the insurance market out there. So the next series of proposals have probably not been as finalized as much as the previous six that I talk about. So I'll have a little bit of hesitation about knowing exactly where the task force is at on these. The next meeting, and on the 20th, these particular recommendations will be finalized. But there's an issue about loss control discounts. This is really the good driver concept. We all know that if you have a good driving record and there are other incentives for good driving, whether it be grades or et cetera, that you might be able to get a better rate on your automobile insurance. Well, the same theory is here on the insurance side, that could we do some regulatory streamlining in the insurance code that would provide an incentive to insurance companies, if they want to provide discounts for contractors that maybe met particular standards, maybe certified contractors, et cetera. That one's fairly self-explanatory, and I don't see a lot of concern with that particular proposal. Wrap project limit, this deals with project wraps. It's how we insure some of the construction projects, and again, it's changing the insurance code to allow for more of a wrap-type insurance on particular construction projects. Then there's two warranty proposals, a first-party warranty for the first year or so, and then a structural warranty on the next page. This would be something that's in addition to what we currently have. This is still in the works, so I probably won't spend a lot of time on this, Mr. Chair, because the task force has not completed its work on this particular one, and I would be a little ahead of them if I was to make commitments there. And then on the general liability coverage issue, this is making sure that as for a contractor requirement to be licensed, that they not only have general liability insurance, but something that's called completed operations. And I believe, Craig, there was an AG's opinion recently that indicated, although it's commonplace in the market for contractors to have a GL policy with completed operations, the law didn't specifically require you to have that completed operations, and the completed operations is really the piece that would protect the consumer after the structure has been built. Is that correct?
I think that's fair to say. There are so many exclusions right now in liability insurance coverage that perhaps is a larger problem than the completed operations, but there was an issue with regard to exactly what kind of insurance the statute required at this point. There was a desire to, by some contractors, to make sure that they weren't obligated to get more than the minimum required. There was a finding by the Attorney General's office that completed operations wasn't required, and a very few contractors, because it doesn't cost that much less, took advantage of that. And I think what this proposal would do would stop that practice, and it would ultimately provide a amount of additional coverage at an additional cost to contractors.
Then the last piece is the data reporting. And one of the things that we found out during the insurance phase of the task force work is there's not a lot of data out there to try to figure out the scope of the problem and what kinds of things you can do to reduce defects. And so one of the discussion points is, can we we hired a consultant. The consultant tried to go out and mine data, from various places and was unsuccessful. So the task force felt that, although not necessarily beneficial for this particular time frame, that if there's a way to get data in the future, you might be able to track some of the things that we're doing, some of the nuances that are occurring in the marketplace, and then make changes accordingly. So they're trying to talk about what kinds of information could we get from the insurance company. This one has quite a bit of concern as well, as you can imagine, and it's not finalized, but that's the idea. Those are the proposals from the task force. As the chair knows, and as I indicated, we hope to have everything buttoned up by December 20th, and I want to work with you to make sure that we have a vehicle for these proposals to be heard during the legislature. It's been quite a bit of work. It's been about 18 months of effort on behalf of the task force. I think we've had over 30 experts come in and testify, 350 different submissions. It's been about 70 different recommendations. Five meetings had public comment alone, as well as invited testimony over the other 13 meetings, and we'd like to make sure that there's an opportunity to see these things go forward once the task force is finalized. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions of the committee.
Questions? Senator Starr.
Thank you. You mentioned residential structures. Residential structures, everything from a single-family, standalone, separate house to multi-story condominium to multi-story apartment. Residential is a pretty broad. I just want to make sure that we're talking about everything from a single-family home to...
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, it's real challenging to define residential, whether you're working in this area or a variety of the other areas. But what the task force wanted to do is make sure that owner-occupied residential structures were covered. So that's your house, that's your townhouse, that's your condos, high-rise, apartments, those kinds of things, where it's owner-occupied. And so that's kind of the gist of the direction of the task force at this point.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good clarification. Owner-occupied, does that mean that if it's a rental, it's not covered?
No, I don't believe so. It was trying to get at the difference between some of the commercial types of structures. I don't want to bore you with details, but at a particular point, I think it's over three stories, you get into the commercial building code, and then that confuses the issue. However, condominiums go higher than that, some apartments. So we're trying to get at where a consumer is impacted versus some kind of a commercial venture, those kinds of things.
So something that the individual has an investment in,
yes,
as compared to just maybe living there.
Exactly. Some kind of, it's a difficult challenge, and we haven't finalized the language, but again, the task force was very clear of not cutting it out at a particular height or just at homes, to make sure that people who are living in these structures, however they're built into whatever we call them on the building code side, that they'd have access to the recovery fund and then some of the other early protections.
Okay. Other questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Comments.
Yes. I did spend two sessions in the House where I was on a Commerce Committee, and actually I've dealt with the Construction Contractors Board and Ways and Means also, but I've heard these issues actually forever. And yeah, I haven't even been on that many committees associated with it. This is actually the most comprehensive effort I've ever seen in this area, and I just wanted to congratulate you for the work that you've done, and I hope the chair feels comfortable that there's time in this session to actually be able to get this into the appropriate vehicles. I don't think you could maybe the question, I don't know if you could even use just one vehicle, but if you feel comfortable that it's achievable in this session.
We're going to do our best to make sure consumers are protected with or without what the task force is bringing forward. I think it's a great work, and I thank Mr. Long and others who have been involved in this. And I think it's one of those things that once we have it out for public debate to get other input as to what the task force has done through the legislative process, I hope that we come out with a product that we all can be comfortable with and believe that we've done the best that we can. But yes, we are. My hope is to move forward on some or all of these components and maybe some others.
Great.
With that, if there's no other questions regarding the update for the task force, then I think the last one area that just for information was on the construction and building codes enforcement issues. Specifically, just as a reminder to the committee, we did have one individual at least come before the committee questioning the ability for quote-unquote legitimate contractors to be able to compete in the marketplace, where you have other individuals who are not playing by the rules, paying under the table, not paying their workers' comp, and putting legitimate contractors in the state at risk of not being able to compete in the marketplace. So I've asked the gentlemen that are seated here as to, you know, information they can give to us as to what we need to be looking at and how we can actually maybe help them carry forward, making certain that those people that are practicing and holding themselves out for business are playing by the same rules that our legitimate contractors are doing, and how we can actually hold them accountable for any wrongdoing they do, and at the same time making certain that those who are playing by the rules are not disadvantaged because someone's shirking their responsibility. Specifically, one area would be not paying workers' comp and undercutting the bids. So with that, and then if there's other areas that you want to give us a little update or perspective of what we need to be honing in on, I'd appreciate that. Right. And yeah, and John Schultz, I know, is here as well, so I don't know if we want to bring him up to the dais at this point. If we can grab another chair. Wonderful, it's right there. And Representative Anderson, I'm just seeing if you're still with us.
I am on the phone, but I can hear Mark and Craig wonderfully. I wasn't able to hear the questions. I think I may just try and tune in on TV.
All right. Thank you.
Let me just make a comment. I'm very encouraged by what I'm hearing today, and I don't have a written report before me, but I'll get it on email here very quickly. And I am encouraged that there's a number of wonderful improvements. I hope the licensure will include hopefully some enforcement for both contractors and inspectors, building inspectors or building officials. Thank you for letting me listen in.
Thank you for being with us. Gentlemen.
Sure. You want to introduce yourself, John, and then I can kind of just give an overview.
Sure. I'm John Schultz, administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you for having me here today.
Mr. Chair, just in general, both Construction Contractors Board, as part of the Claims Task Force recommendations, as well as your own legislation, have recommendations to the legislature on enhancing enforcement, as you saw. We do as well at the Building Codes Division, additional enforcement capacities. And then one of the things that you kind of talked about, and I know the three of us actually participated in a joint effort earlier this year in Central Oregon?
Yes.
In Central Oregon, our agencies did, to address this very issue. And I think that, I don't want to steal anybody's thunder, you guys probably have the details better, but we are continuing to look at ways that all the agencies that are kind of involved in business licensing and regulation, whether it be on the construction side or employment or workers' comp or taxation, are working together to try to address these kinds of issues. You want to talk about, because I know you have the stats and kind of what you're doing over at workers' comp and what we did earlier this year.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I was requested to provide some information about our enforcement activities and whether or not there were other things that we needed to enhance those enforcement activities. And as you mentioned, we were here in January and talked a little bit about that. And at that time, I did share and wanted to reshare that the Workers' Compensation Division conducts about 15,000 coverage investigations a year that resulted in last year in 2005, a finding of 545 non-compliant employers with assessed penalties of $9.6 million. So this is an area that we take very seriously. As Mark indicated, we started to look at what can we do already under the statutes that we already have, And one of the things that we did was engage in what we called a sweep. In September, the Workers' Compensation Division, Building Codes Division, Construction Contractors Board, along with Department of Revenue and the Employment Department, canvassed building construction activities in the Bend area. This sweep for the Workers' Compensation Division resulted in 242 investigations of employers to determine whether or not they purchased adequate workers' compensation coverage. The news was pretty good, frankly. 224 of those investigations are completed. By this time, we found that 91% of the contractors were in compliance. We found five contractors who were not in compliance. There's 18 investigations that are still pending. There's issues that are a little bit more complex there, and we're trying to determine whether or not they're in compliance or not. We also made a commitment to the constituent, Mr. Cook, from Eugene, who addressed the committee in January, to assign a specific investigator, a contact person for Mr. Cook, so he had somebody to work with in terms of any investigation referrals that he came up with. So far, he has contacted our investigator, but so far all of the referrals that he's made, we have found that the businesses have been in compliance with the law, and for various reasons. Either they had coverage or they were using temporary employees, were working through a worker leasing company, or were not a subject employer. Other things that we've been doing is really trying to leverage, as Mark mentioned, interagency activities. There's a lot we can already do if we're willing to take advantage of our opportunities. Through the Construction Contractors Board, for example, letters have been sent to 8,000 what we call non-exempt licensees to advise them that they need to secure workers' compensation coverage to meet their licensure requirements. Of those 8,000, we followed up on all of those and ended up issuing 10 non-complying employer orders. 10 of them, in essence, did not follow through and get their workers' compensation coverage. By the way, all of these employers are now in compliance. They all did eventually follow up and get their workers' compensation coverage. We're also on a quarterly basis reviewing these non-exempt contractors with records and data that we're getting from the Employment Department in order to better match potential subject employers. And what I mean by that is matching those contractors who are reporting to employment that they're paying unemployment insurance, but they don't have workers' compensation coverage that we know of, which would be a problem. We've also been participating in the Interagency Steering Committee on the Independent Contractor Activities. That committee's been working with stakeholders to develop new rules to ensure there's a consistent application of laws and better education for business, because one of the problems that Senate Bill 323 from last session addressed was that different agencies are operating with different laws and there's different expectations. So far what that committee's accomplished is they've created a statewide website that's jointly managed, educational material as well as proposing new administrative rules. The next step for that committee is to develop a comprehensive enforcement plan. Finally, in addition to our more routine activities, we have, in conjunction with the Oregon Home Builders Association, been providing training sessions to contractors, and specifically in regard to their coverage responsibilities. Recent trainings were just completed in Coos Bay and Klamath Falls. Mark at Building Codes has kindly been publishing information about workers' compensation laws to the construction trades through their quarterly Code Links newsletter. So what we have been doing, to repeat what Mark said, is looking at what can we already do to leverage cooperation and get out to the contractors and do a better job of enforcing their workers' compensation coverage responsibilities. So I'd be glad to answer questions, and I know that Craig has a few comments to make.
Mr. Smith, why don't you go ahead and make your comments, and we'll take questions at that point if there's any.
Chair Przanski is a member of the committee. Again, Craig Smith, Contractors Board. I've handed out a memo that I had staff prepare that describes the partnership that CCB has with Workers' Comp Division, the kind of things we've been doing to try to ensure that contractors who are engaged in work that requires employees are paying attention to workers' comp laws. And you can see what we've done is to adjust some of our data, handle our website a little bit differently, and also go out on the sweeps that John mentioned and Mark mentioned. Those sweeps are, I think, among the most important things that we can do, because we are seen out in the field. Maybe we don't find a lot of non-complying activity, but part of the problem is that contractors don't think that the state's there. And if we can show the flag from time to time, as well as actually find some contractors out of compliance, we're going to reduce the amount of non-complying activity. So we're happy to work with Mark and his crew, and really appreciate his leadership in arranging for the most recent sweeps. We've done some sweeps on top of that, and this my little memo that I put out and you have in front of you will describe some of that activity. We also have in the room today Director Herchenko from the Department of Revenue, who has been working diligently with, I think one could say, to a degree, herding cats in trying to get some of these issues resolved. And I know that she would accept your invitation if you'd like her to address the issue of the independent contractor definition and how that is an important ingredient in trying to reduce this non-complying behavior.
Okay, first, before we ask her up, is there any questions for anyone at the dais now?
Yeah.
Senator Mexer, sorry.
Thanks. Well, that is a very fascinating issue, and I'm glad you're working to address it. I know this last summer, being out and about a lot, I talked to a number of folks. I have a lot of development going on in my district, East Clackamas County, as you can imagine, and Damascus and Boring, and just, you know, every week, you know, it just seems like there's, you know, a few hundred more homes going up, and so people are very cognizant of this. And I spoke to a lot of just folks in general and some contractors, you know, as you visit them at their homes, they're contractors, and heard on numerous occasions, you know, people who are very upset about, you know, see this home, these guys are using these guys, and among other things, aren't paying workers' comp, I'm doing this, and I know, you know, this type of thing. And I was just kind of wondering is, because it sounds like you're really trying to get to the core of this, and of course in our committee last year we did 323 and trying to define this and how it's applied. But I would just kind of wonder if you could briefly kind of tell me maybe your process, because you've got the situation where, say, when you're out in the field and you find an employer, you know, part of it is looking at what they're carrying, you know, they're going to reference the fact, well, our framers here or whatever are independent contractors and I just hire them. And, you know, not only ensuring that the employer is right, but that the people who are representing themselves to be independent contractors, you know, are actually following that rule as we have modified with 323, because certainly in most of the construction situations that I can imagine, most of the qualifying factors, the majority of them that would require to be an independent contractor or an employer, in building a residence would qualify them as an employer. You know, they're told where to go, when to do, what, you know, under supervision and control. And I think it is so important, not only from a competitive standpoint, from the builder who's trying to do everything right and make sure his employees are covered, but they're in a field, unlike a secretary maybe in some office whose risk is very low for workers' comp needs. You know, they got nail guns and everything else, and there's going to be a cost to the general public if something goes wrong and then there's not a way to compensate for that loss. So I'm just kind of curious, what kind of process, when you go out in the field, like you say, you show the flag, to determine not only the employer, but that the people that are working for them, that they're not both kind of skirting the rules and ensuring that the people who are doing these things are protected.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Metzger, you bring apart, you bring to the forefront really the major problem, which is how do you police a situation where the subcontractor who has obtained a qualifying license and has certified that they're going to behave in a certain manner, particularly they're not going to be directed and controlled, how do you police it when the primary contractor then directs and controls the activities of the sub, and what kind of problems does that flow from that problem? And we think that this is an important issue that the Independent Contractor Steering Committee is trying to address. Part of that is education. Quite frankly, we have a law right now that I think that there is a, as we discussed the other day, I think in the construction industry there is a culture wherein the primary contractor pretty much controls the activities of the subs. And in to some degree, they don't know where the line is. And I think there's some education that needs to go with this issue. I think that whether or not you choose to change statutes on down the line, there may be some pressure to do that. But right now, the way the law is written, there probably is a significant amount of noncompliance with the independent contractor visa or versus employee statutes. And I think the answer is going to be probably some education. The website that the steering committee has launched is going to help. Perhaps some of this continuing education could help as well.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, if I may, I would add, again, this is John Schultz, I would add that in the past, primarily the Workers' Compensation Division was in a reactive mode, primarily. We tried to do a lot of prevention to prevent employers from falling into a non-complying employer situation by following up when there was cancellation of coverage and talking to the employer themselves and asking a series of questions, which really amounts to, do you really want to do this, and trying to provide education. Also, following up on claims that get filed, and we find a significant number of non-compliant employers that way when somebody gets hurt. But that's after the fact, and it's too late. What's changed, I think, in the last couple of years is number one, there's a lot more data sharing that's going on between the agencies. There's just some easy and common sense things that we can take a look at. Like, for example, if they're paying on the quarterly payroll assessment into the employment division, indicating they've got employees, but they don't have workers' compensation insurance, that's a big red flag for us to go follow up. And then in terms of what do we do, either in an investigation where we go out or on a sweep, we basically have a series of questions that we ask both the main contractor and then the subcontractor or the employees, that the questions that basically follow common law that the courts have determined under these questions it's going to fall one way or the other. And we've trained our investigative staff, and we have 13 investigators who engage in this behavior, you know, go out and follow up specifically. And they are trained to ask these questions and essentially try to ferret out, does somebody need workers' compensation insurance or not? And I think there's two good things that comes out of that. One is you're going to find some people who need workers' compensation insurance, and we get them into compliance. And that's our main goal, is to get the employer into compliance. The other piece is that it sets a tone, and word gets around, as Craig said, that the state is out there and we're showing the flag. That information is shared, and it's especially shared if you go out once and then you follow up and go out again into the same areas and continue to demonstrate that you're serious about this issue, that it's important, and you're going, and that we are going to put our resources, time, and our energy into following up on it.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much, unless there's other comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Director Elizabeth Harchenko, would you like to come up and give us a few comments?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. It's a pleasure to come and talk to you today about the work of the five agencies that are partnering in implementing Senate Bill 323, which revised and updated the definition of independent contractor that the Construction Contractors Board, Landscape Contractors Board, Workers' Comp Division, Revenue Department, and Employment Department all look to in trying to draw that very difficult line between who's an employee and who's independently in business for themselves and isn't subject to the requirements of carrying unemployment insurance, workers' comp insurance, and having payroll tax withholding. Craig asked me to come and just give you a high-level overview of what's going on in the task force. Some of the things that we're doing have already been mentioned. I've sharing with you a brochure. This is the first of several that, you know, we expect to produce. This is the general information about the difference between employees and independent contractors. It has the website that was referred to, displayed contact information for the five agencies, and some basic information about questions you ask yourself to begin to answer the question, is this person I'm looking at an employee or an independent contractor? The agencies are working currently on some administrative rules to further explain how we understand the statute and how we will apply it. And we're taking on the challenges of construction and landscape businesses because of the use of the subcontractor system that, as you've been discussing, sometimes has some lack of clarity about the status of someone who's working in within a larger project where there's a general contractor who's got subcontracts with people doing everything from the framing and the roofing to the flooring and the lighting and the heating and so forth. We plan to create brochures that are industry specific, so there will be some coming out that will talk specifically about the circumstances in those particular industries. And the cooperation that was mentioned, we have joined those agencies on some of the sweeps that have gone on over the last couple of years. We've done some cross training with Employment Department and Workers' Compensation on the questions that you ask and what you look for when you are when you're evaluating a business to see whether the folks that are working together are independent business people or whether there are employees. It's a challenge because the way that our courts have at least look at half of the test, which is freedom from direction and control by a person for whom you're performing services, is one that's very much specific to the facts of the relationship. And it's hard to know going in what the behavior is going to be. It ends up, we look at things afterwards and say, okay, what actually happened? And then say, okay, this was employment or it wasn't employment. And when the parties have had a different expectation and have gone into a relationship believing that what was there was independent relationship and didn't then follow through with workers' comp coverage or unemployment insurance payments or income tax withholding, then the consequences are unpleasant afterwards. We're trying to do as much as we can to get information out there so that folks who want to make the right call have the information they need in order to do it. But there always is the economic incentive in a very competitive business to try to keep costs down, and what we've heard as we've talked especially to folks in the construction trades is that sometimes that workers' comp insurance premium cost is high enough that there's a lot of incentive to try to avoid paying it. So I'd be happy to answer any questions about the work that the agencies are doing together to try to at least be as clear as possible with folks in the business world what the rules are and how to get more information and assistance if they're having trouble making a call that they're confident is the right one in terms of the nature of a relationship.
Questions? Yeah, Senator Devlin.
I know that there are probably 1,000 different examples of how things are set up. But one of the things that I've been seeing a lot more of lately is not as much, you always see the things that are just practically normal have always been there in terms of maybe a construction site and there are a dozen more subcontractors. Even if you go away from if anything's inappropriate or not, that has been pretty much the standard way that that's been done for years, even when you didn't even believe you had a problem and maybe you didn't. But what I see more of is like individual purpose contractors or sort of sole purpose, like roofing, others, where you have one party that is the sort of the advertised party, that is the person that solicits the business, that does the bid, that basically represents themselves as the contractor. And the moment they do that, then a new crew comes basically and that has no real association with them. That's not necessarily registered with the contractor's board. They're not necessarily in a formal subcontractor arrangement. They're not necessarily a whole lot of things. But it just seems like a relatively, how would I say it, almost like a, it's very entrepreneurial. Because if you can get the work and then find someone else to do it for considerably less than the bid that's been accepted by the party that's getting it. It just seems that it's far more common now. I mean, even the thing about, a contractor with multiple subcontractors, that's always been there. But when you call for practically any service and there seems to be a disconnect between the parties that are actually making the arrangements with the consumers and the parties that are actually coming out to do the work. It's just one of the examples that I'm seeing more of and getting more consumer complaints about.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I've learned a lot about how this plays out, in the world, having been on starting in the task force and kind of working from the abstract and now getting down into the concrete, talking with, well, that was probably not. getting down into the real application of the question of relationships, and I think that there are a number of things that come into play that have results like you described, and I don't believe there is a single solution to that. There's a lot of freedom in this country to, as long as you don't violate the law, to do business in a variety of ways. We've got traditional employment relationships where you have someone who has a business, they hire people, they train them, they know that those folks, if they do quality work, then the business gets the recognition and the enhanced reputation from that quality work. Other people like to see they see a way or a market niche of making money by connecting A, who has the ability to do some work, with B, who needs the work, and just taking basically a commission for it. And those things are all blending and blurring through a wide variety of different industries where they didn't happen in the past. And so it is, I think, in a sense, it is entrepreneurial in a very broad way, but it doesn't fit nicely into the rules that have been in place in the law for a long time, and that's one of the challenges, that as we look at things like how clearly can we describe the differences between being an employee and being an independent contractor, may not be the right question. It's what's the social policy that having that distinction makes so that makes having that distinction so important, and as we try to just make sure that for purposes of workers' comp coverage and unemployment insurance, that people who are truly employees and not independent business people do have the protections that the statute says they should have, and that costs money to somebody, then the pressure to push against that definition and really only put people in that employee category if they can't get them out of it because of the economics results in those very interesting sorts of outcomes. And you know, the licensing boards are trying to make sure that people are competent to do work that they represent that they're able to do so that consumers can rely on that competence and get the product that they're expecting, like a home that's habitable or landscape work where the sprinkler system works and so forth. That's about consumer protection. It isn't necessarily about making sure that there's workers' comp coverage for people who are supposed to be getting it under the workers' comp law. So there's some integration here that the laws, as they're starting to come together or as we're talking to each other, the different agencies, it's not seamless. And it's very, very challenging to try to keep up, I think, with economic pressures in the marketplace that may push people to engage in a certain kind of behavior or try and structure their business in a certain way that then seems to undermine another public policy in another place. But we're doing the best we can, I think, to at least get information out there, tailor it to particular types of business areas so that folks have the information, and then the conversation you were having with the three folks that were up here before me is just as important. Is there an appropriate amount of effort being put into verifying that the behavior that is expected is what's happening out there, and if it isn't, then what are some other solutions?
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't necessarily have a question as much as a comment, and it relates to Senator Devlin's question or comments. The what I see, and I had 20 years of primarily roofing, is that relationship between the builder and the subcontractors. I mean, if the builder was stupid, he didn't protect himself. But most builders I know aren't stupid, and the relationship between the subcontractor and the builder was very well defined. And you know, from my experience, builders made absolutely certain that the things that were required of me by law that I had as a subcontractor. And the ability to create really a symphony of tradespeople coming in working in concert together to create a home for a client really is quite remarkable. No question though that unfortunately we're in the business of legislating the exceptions, and that's the frustrating part about this business we're in. By and large, I think the vast majority of the building world are conscientious and detail-oriented and provide a great product for the consumer. Unfortunately, we have to create hurdles and obstacles and barriers and burdens for the good guys to catch the bad guys, and that's frustrating for me.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
How difficult would your job be if there wasn't voluntary compliance with our income tax laws?
Mr. Chair, it's definitely impossible.
Yes.
Okay. I think we're into another new committee here. Thank you very much for coming forward. With that said, that's going to close the informational meeting, and I'm going to open up a work session at this time for an introduction of committee bills. And before we go there, I'm going to ask Judith to kind of give us an overview of the bills that we have before us. Some of them are in LC form. I guess all of them are at this point. And what we're going to do is I'm going to ask that we have a motion to adopt these bills as committee bills. It does not mean that any of us are going to be supporting the bill as it moves forward in its present state or any state after this introduction, but just as a matter to get the bills introduced as pre-session file, and that they will be on their way to be logged with the Secretary of the Senate, and then to the President's office for dispersal into the committees. So with that said, that disclaimer for everyone, so we don't have to feel that we need to itemize each of the bills in detail. Judith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, just for convenience, we'll go through by numeric order of the LC draft. We'll start with LC 1307. That concept would prohibit the creation of a paper record that shows more information than the consumer's name and five digits of their either credit card or debit card number. It would allow the Attorney General to adopt rules to implement this provision. In some interim period between the current law and when this might take effect, if the Legislative Assembly adopts it, it would require a person to shred, incinerate, or otherwise destroy a receipt or record once they put it on microfiche, microfilm, or within 36 months of the date of that transaction if they do have such a record. And it again allows the Attorney General to adopt rules to implement that transitional period as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and why don't we just, if there's any questions for members that want to ask specifically about these at this point, they probably do it that way instead of going through them all. I can tell you that I am working with Julie Brandis of the Association of Oregon Industries on this bill. She's getting feedback from her members, and we will continue to work on it as it moves through the process with business to make certain that we are hearing their needs and concerns before we move it into hearing process. All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you entertain a motion on all of these, or do we want to go through each one like that? Or
no, I'm willing to just put on the record what the LC is, what the summary is, and then just have them adopt it.
I would concur with that.
So with that said, why don't you just give us the LC and then the summary, and we'll move forward.
Okay. The next one then, Mr. Chair, members, would be LC 1819, if we're going in numeric order here. This was previously Senate Bill 321 last session. It does modify a definition of employment relations with respect to staffing and safety issues for those employees that are involved in collective bargaining. Next, we have LC 1824, which last session was Senate Bill 931, dealing with creating a standard for fire-safe cigarettes. Next, we have LC 1850. That deals with the powers of the Construction Contractors Board that they have to revoke, suspend, or refuse to issue or reissue a license or assess civil penalties. It would add a grounds for sanctions if the board found that the licensee has performed work negligently or improperly or has failed to diligently pursue the completion of the work, and then it does increase the maximum civil penalty that the board is allowed to invoke from $5,000 to $10,000. And then finally, we have LC 1851, which deals with instances when an agency overrides an administrative law judge's ruling. It deals with the standard of evidence for which that is allowed from a preponderance of the evidence to, in fact, clear and convincing evidence that would have the agency demonstrate that before overriding an administrative law judge's ruling. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. So the chair would entertain a motion for the adoption of LC 1307, 1819, 1824, 1850, and 1851 as committee bills.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
All right. And is there any objection to the motion that's been brought forward by Senator Devlin? Not hearing any, that will be, that act or that motion will be adopted, and they will be entered as committee bills. And again, for everyone that's listening on the radio, TV, and everything else, This is just a means to allow these bills to get into the process. There is no commitment or obligation on any of the members here to support any portion of the bill as it's been introduced or what might be the outcome of a through an amendment process. So with that said, committee, is there anything else that we need to cover? And if not, I want to thank everyone for being here. This is our last meeting scheduled for the interim Senate Consumer Protection Committee, and I appreciate y'all being part of it, and we look forward to working with each and every one of us, I guess, as we go through this process. So thank you very much, and we're adjourned.